Hello and welcome to Galactic Chat. I'm David McDonald, and today I have the really exciting opportunity to talk to one of my favourite short fiction writers. So with me today I have Ken Liu, who is an American science fiction writer, poet, lawyer and computer programmer. His short stories have appeared in Fantasy and Science Fiction, Asimov's, Analog, Lightspeed, Clark's World and other magazines, as well as several anthologies, including The Year's Best Science Fiction. He is also a translator of science fiction and literary stories from Chinese into English. His short story, The Paper Menagerie, is the first work of fiction of any length to have swept the Nebula, Hugo and World Fantasy Awards. His short story, Mono Nowhere, won the 2013 Hugo, and his novella, The Man Who Ended History, a documentary, was also nominated for a Hugo. So thanks for joining me, Ken.
Thank you very much, David. Glad to be here.
So you're one of the most successful and prolific modern writers of short stories. What is it about the form that attracts you?
You know, I think it's very funny that people always think I'm prolific, when in fact, I probably write the slowest of all the writers I know. I mean, you know, if you go on Twitter, you see all the writers post their word counts. Everybody's like, oh, I just wrote 1,000 words in 45 minutes. I wrote 2,000 words in 30 minutes, you know. And I'm just like, I don't know how you guys do this, because I would be lucky if I get 500 words a night. You know, that's the rate that I can probably carry off. So it's always bizarre for me to be described, for me to hear myself described as prolific, because I'm really actually not very productive in terms of being efficient and speedy. I do think that the short form is particularly attractive as a form for people who, like me, are really into exploring ideas and tend to have short attention spans, because I like to get into a world and do something very quick and deep, but not necessarily broad and try to work out every detail. I think the short form is particularly attractive to me in the past for that reason. It allows you to easily and quickly explore with a variety of techniques, a variety of world-building ideas, different types of economics, science, magical systems, without being sort of tied up in the details and making sure everything works in the way that a novel demands you to. So I would say, you know, the experimental nature of the form, I think, is particularly interesting to me.
Where perhaps you could afford to risk being experimental, because you're not looking at throwing out 100,000 words rather than, you know, 7,000 or 5,000 words.
That's exactly right. I wrote this story for Apex at one point called Before and After. The entire story is really just one sentence that went on for hundreds and hundreds of words. You know, I think that story actually was, readers have reacted to it fairly favorably, and I did it as a literary experiment. That is obviously the kind of thing that you can do in a short story that you cannot do in a novel. I think if you try to write a novel with a single sentence, it will be an interesting experiment. I seriously doubt many readers would enjoy the result, and you would be 100,000 words into it before you realize that's the problem.
Now, I'm going to indulge my own curiosity here for a moment, but we talk with novelists, we talk about plotters and pantsers or gardeners and architects and different methods. Do you have a particular process for short stories? Do you have an idea of where it's going to go, or do you just start writing and see what happens? Do you have a particular method you use?
I don't think I have one particular method. I've tried a variety of different things. Sometimes I've tried to outline the whole thing ahead of time. Sometimes I've tried to just go with it. They all work and they all not work. I think every story is different. They sort of demand their own method. I've heard, you know, a lot of novelists say that every book is different. They demand their own approach and methodology. And I think short stories are actually quite similar, at least for me. I've never found one particular approach to be any more effective for me as a universal technique. Every story seems to demand its own experimental method and approach. I guess the most common approach I use, if there is one, is I try to write a story in the same way that I imagine sculpting is done. So I sort of do the first draft. That's sort of a rough outline of where things will go. It actually, in that, in doing the first drive, I'm actually very much a pantser in that case. I don't necessarily know exactly how things will work out. I know I may have a single line, I may have one sentence or a core idea of some sort. Then I just sort of write the story and see where it takes me. And that's just the zero or first draft. And then I start chipping away at it in the way that sculpting would be done, and shaping it repeatedly until it's closer to what I had in my mind when I first started drafting the story. It doesn't always work. There are some stories I've trunked because the vision I had in mind turned out to be just not something that I could approach given my abilities. But it also has worked pretty well. A lot of my stories, including many that have received fairly good feedback from readers, were done that way. So I guess that sort of works.
So in terms of other short story writers, are there any particular writers from the past that influenced you as you began writing, or that you enjoyed so much that inspired you to write short stories?
That's a hard question to answer. I mean, the thing is, you know, I think most of us sort of receive or are exposed to short stories in school, at least in the U.S., that's the case. A lot of short stories that we read, we did so during high school English class because the short story is a good chunk for teaching at the high school English level. I do remember being extremely moved by Ray Bradbury's short stories in particular, and Philip K. Dick as writers when I was trying to learn how to do this. But too many people in my education have been, you know, important figures for me to really just make a huge list of everyone. I would say that all the short stories that I've read over the years, both in school and just as for fun, have influenced me to some degree. And to the extent that my work is appealing to people, I think you can hear echoes of all of these short story writers that have come before me in them.
Now, obviously, we'll start with a disclaimer that you're always going to miss people. You can't list everybody. But are there any contemporary short story writers who you particularly admire or would like to be able to write like, I guess?
Yeah, that's a fair question and a good question. I've very much admired Rachel Swirsky's work. I think she is just an amazing prose stylist. I think I would love to have her ability to control voice and to just make the words just draw such a beautiful picture and to really have the music in the prose. That's something I always try to strive for. Helena Bell is another one who just is an amazing prose stylist. Hell's stories are just fantastic. Her pieces are incredible. I read them and they are, you know, they're poetry, and she is a poet, so that obviously makes perfect sense. But I would love to be able to do prose the way she can. And these people have definitely inspired me a great deal.
Do you think there's any writers out there who are perhaps overlooked that you would suggest people seek out?
There are many writers who are overlooked, I would say. I mean, you know, the reality is I am sure that there are more great writers than there are editors who are able to publish all the great writers who are writing out there. It's just a fact of the market that the short fiction market in genre is fairly limited, even despite the success of a lot of new magazines and online markets. We still just don't have enough markets for all the great fiction that's being written. I don't want to name anyone specific because there are many people I know who write wonderfully and I think they should be published more. And if you mention, you know, some names, then you're going to leave other people out and I'm going to just hate myself later for not bringing people up. But I would say in general, it is the case that we need more editors and we need more markets. We need more diversity in the types of stories that we get to publish. And to the extent that, you know, we can all help support the fluorescence of more markets to get more writers who write something a little bit out of the usual path an opportunity to shine, I think we should try to do that, because there really is just a lot more talent out there than can be showcased.
Well, it's certainly been a very positive thing for short story writers in terms of the amount of Kickstarters, successful Kickstarters. I can think particularly of Nightmare Magazine and Lightspeed, which have
absolutely
created more markets. Now, I was reading a very interesting article, I think by Jason Sanford, which I'll link back to in the notes, of this, where he was talking about how writing short stories is not particularly the avenue to success.
I remember reading that.
did you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think Jason's right. If you're talking about, you know, I think Jason defined very carefully in the blog post what he meant by success. That's literary or popular acclaim as well as commercial success. And I think that's true. Being a short story writer is not the easiest path or even a very good path to achieve those goals. You know, Ted Chiang might be the only person I know who has managed to do that through the short form alone. But, you know, Ted Chiang is kind of the single exception that proves the rule. Ted can achieve what he did because he is exceptional. And I think most writers probably don't have much chance of repeating that. It's just, you know, this is something that I've said before. Well, it's because the short form is so experimental, it attracts a lot of innovative work. But at the same time, I think it demands quite a bit from the reader. It demands a lot of, I think the most jarring thing for readers about reading the short form is that just as you're getting settled into the world and just as you're getting to enjoy and get used to this new way of thinking and the new world that's being built and the new character and getting to like them, the story's over. And so there's a huge context switching cost as you go through multiple short stories. I think it's harder to write 10 short stories of 5,000 word each than to write a 50,000 word short novel. And I think reading 10 short stories of 5,000 words each is also harder than reading a single novel of the total length. The context switching cost is just very high. And so as a fact, there's just not that many people reading short stories. So if you want to achieve success, and I think the most important measure of success is to reach readers, you have to connect with readers. If your goal is to connect with more readers, or at least with the readers that you want to reach, novels do have a much better chance of doing that than short stories. So, you know, in that respect, I think Jason's right. But at the same time, short stories are very valuable. There's no doubt that you learn a lot from doing them. Whether you necessarily learn the same things that would be useful in writing a novel is open to debate. But you do learn a lot about how to write. You do learn a lot about yourself. You learn a lot about what kind of stories you like, what kind of stories you want to tell, what makes you excited, what kind of person and what kind of writer you are in doing short fiction work. So, you know, I think short fiction is valuable in its own right, and not necessarily just as some sort of training camp for novels, even though some writers may still think that's the case. But that's actually not the case. I mean, obviously, many novelists today are successful without writing short stories at all, without ever having published short stories at all. So that's certainly not necessary for success in the long form. So I think if you enjoy writing short fiction, you should do it for its own sake, because I do agree that it's not a great path to literary success, if that's what you're after.
I'm a short story writer, not a novelist, so I was interested to get your thoughts on some of that.
Well, I'm known as a short story writer too, so I've thought about that quite a bit, and it is an interesting question. I mean, have you ever thought about going into novels, or is it just not a form that you're interested in at all?
Oh, I'm working on I've got a first draft of a novel, and and an outlined military sci-fi, and I'm working on a YA collaboration with an American writer at the moment. But I guess I'm at a very different stage than you. I'm still sort of trying to develop my writing and all that sort of stuff. And I agree completely that it's not just a training ground for novels, but it's certainly a way of improving your writing. And plus,
definitely. Oh, by the way, congrats on your nomination for the WSFA Small Press Award.
Oh, thank you. It was a big surprise. But looking at the names who have been nominated for it and who have won it, it was a bit of validation that I'm maybe starting to get there.
I was very proud of that that award when I got it. They picked one of my favorite stories, so I definitely think it's a very worthy honor.
Yeah, no, it seems very prestigious, and to me, small press is so important. I mean, that's where many writers, that's their first chance of working with an editor and seeing their name in print, and they often do things that some of the bigger houses might not risk.
Yes, absolutely.
So, no, it was very, very exciting. So,
well, I mean, I was really glad that they picked Alex's story this year, because I think explaining Cthulhu to Grandma might not be a story that would be favored by one of the other awards. But, it's certainly a great story and deserved to be recognized. So I was glad to see it.
Yeah. Now, I sort of wasn't really familiar with his stuff, but now that I've sort of seen him on the list, I've checked out his website and everything, and there's certainly a long list of stories to choose from to start reading. So he's doing some good stuff by the look of it.
Yes. I definitely. Yeah. I mean, again, Alice is another one who's a short story writer who is moving to do some novels. But he also started as a short story writer, same as you and me. So it's definitely sort of the short story market is still a place where a lot of writers do prove themselves. So it's certainly not dead. It's just not a great, I just don't think people should get into it with the idea that they're training for novels, because that's not what happens.
No, I don't think anyone should write anything because of the idea that they might become successful or famous. I think the reality is that unless you're in writing because you love writing, you're gonna struggle as well. So there's that aspect as well as the not seeing it as training, also not seeing any form of writing as the road to riches or fame, I think. So, Ken, you've been one of the champions of the translation of non-English works into English, particularly Chinese works. Why is this something that's important to you?
Well, I want to be careful here because, by saying it's important, I fear that it's going to come across to readers and listeners as though I'm saying this is reading translated work is something like literary vitamins for you. It's good for you. It's important. You got to do it. No, that's not really what I have in mind at all. I'm very, very interested in translated fiction just because, I think there's just so much human diversity of imagination, of experience, of culture, of the way of looking at the world. It's a good thing for us to try to be exposed to as much of that as possible, not because it's, important or quote-unquote the right thing to do, even though it is, but I think it's more important because it's fun. It's enjoyable. It's interesting. I think, life is boring if you don't try to experience things that are different from what you're used to. And I think translated fiction has a lot of potential of giving you that kind of different novelty, that ability to let you see that many things you take for granted are not really universal, that you get to see something about the full scope of the human experience. So in that sense, I think reading translated fiction is important, just because it's fun and it's neat. I have been lucky in that I consider myself to be schooled in the very traditional Western canon of literature and of genre literature. But I also have been exposed and also inherited from this vast treasure trove of Chinese heritage, literary heritage. So because I have the ability to do so, I've considered it as part of my duty to do some work in translating the really excellent works of Chinese genre work in Chinese genre fiction that I enjoy into English so that I get to share them with more readers here. And I've been very blessed to have had the opportunity to work with some excellent Chinese writers and to introduce their works to Anglophone audiences. And so far the responses for my translation have been very good, far exceeding my expectations. So I'm glad to be able to build this bridge and connect writers with more readers, which I think is something that all writers and all readers want.
So what are some of the challenges that come with the translation process?
There's a lot. I think one of the most interesting things to me after doing translation for a while is that there are works that are difficult to translate and there are works that are easy to translate. And the reason why they're difficult or easy are almost never related to language. There's this common misunderstanding that, you know, some languages have words that other languages don't have words for, and that's what makes it difficult. Well, that's kind of silly. I mean, anybody who has taken some linguistics and who has actually really studied languages can tell you that the very notion of words is fluid and arbitrary, and the idea that you have a word in a language that in another language requires some periphrasis and some phrase is really not that big a deal. It's just not that big a distinction. Language itself is almost never that big an issue. And I don't really think many of the things that people pay attention to when they talk about translation from Chinese, like, you know, well, Chinese doesn't have tenses in the same way that English does, so that must make it very difficult. Well, not really. That's Chinese has plenty of auxiliaries that end up giving you the same kind of result as tenses would, so it doesn't really matter. So a lot of these superficial differences between languages are turn out not to be all that relevant and all that interesting in terms of translation difficulty. What is far more difficult is culture. I think what tends to be untranslatable, quote-unquote, is not a linguistic feature, even though sometimes people use some sort of linguistic description to say that it's a language feature that's making translation difficult. It's not. It's culture. Chinese literature is particularly interesting because written Chinese is a unique creation. It is not an exact reflection of any vernacular form of the Sinetic languages. Without getting too deeply into it, the written Chinese is a very strange thing. Not because of linguistics, but because of the culture background it reflects. There's a huge amount of classical Chinese expressions that have survived in written Chinese as a kind of culture treasure trove and set of references. It's hard for me to convey a sense of this to Anglophone readers in general, because the standard for what is considered good literary expression is just so different. So, for example, this will sound kind of strange, but I actually think it's a good illustration of the issue. There's an old Star Trek The Next Generation episode called Darmok. I don't know if you remember, but it's the one where Picard has to learn to communicate with this alien race where they speak in historical allusions and metaphors. So they would say, you know, so-and-so stand at this city, which is a reference to an ancient story that if you know the story, you would be able to know what the sentiment that's being expressed is. There's a comparison between the experiences of the characters in that historical story and the present situation. But unless you know the historical phrase, the historical story, you wouldn't be able to make head or tails out of these names and events. So it's a heavily elusive form of expressing yourself by citing to ancient stories. Chinese actually is a lot like that. Many, many Chinese idioms and fixed expressions are allusions to historical events and historical stories that have a very rich set of cultural associations and meanings. So one of the stories I wrote is something called, it's for the Long Hidden Anthology, and the title of the story is Nodding Grass, Holding Rain, which is actually a literal translation of a Chinese idiom that is itself an allusion to two historical stories that together give you the meaning of the expression. But unless you know the historical stories that are being referenced, you wouldn't know what the story is about. Sort of like us saying the sword of Damocles, and people would know what that means. But that's a fairly rare example of a Western expression that has acquired that kind of meaning. Chinese is literally filled with expressions of that sort. There's nothing linguistically strange about any of this. You know, they're just abbreviations, historical allusions. But the cultural significance of such allusions is very hard to convey in a translation. I mean, one way to do it would be to do the translation and then fill it with footnotes, pages and pages of footnotes to explain every single allusion and every single historical reference, and then try to explain why the expression is used this way. Is it being used ironically? Is it being used literally? Is it being used as some form of criticism? Is it used as a form of veiled reference to the present? And that just becomes super unwieldy. So as a translator, a lot of times you have to take those fixed expressions and historical allusions and try to do something with them that makes sense. But inevitably you lose a huge amount of cultural richness and nuance in the process of doing so. So that's just one example, you know, the way that historical allusions are so pervasive and important in Chinese literary writing, and yet almost impossible to translate into English in any way that's satisfactory. And cultural things like that are very hard to do. Another example would be the variety of diminutives and nicknames that Chinese culture gives to people. The way you refer to someone, the nicknames you use, and the kind of diminutives you use show a lot about the relationship between the speaker and the person that's being addressed. Similarly, Chinese has a huge variety of kinship terms that are very distinct. Your cousin, who is your father's brother's son, is a different kind of cousin than from your mother's brother's son. These kind of kinship distinctive terms are very important, and they give meaning to Chinese cultural practices that are just not apparent when you're translating from Chinese into English. Sometimes even if you explain exactly what the kinship relationship is, it doesn't really tell the reader anything, because unless you have a deep understanding of what Chinese inheritance laws are like and what historically these kinship relationships meant, just knowing the term still doesn't tell you anything. So I find those kind of things, those fundamental cultural assumptions and cultural ways of expressing yourself, to be really difficult to translate. And, you know, it's a puzzle. It's something that I've constantly worked on, and I don't think there's a universal answer to it. It's just a challenge that has to be constantly worked out. Sorry, it's a bit rambling as an answer, but it happens to be a question that I'm very passionate about.
So I was going to say that I was wondering, is the market now, do you feel the market's now more welcoming and open to translated works? Are there more opportunities for translated works to come out into the mainstream?
That's a good question. I'm not sure I know the answer to that. I know that when I first started doing translations, it was pretty hard to place them. It could be that I just wasn't very good at doing them, and it took me a while to learn the craft properly. These days, I found many markets to be open to them. I mean, there are some markets who will say, we don't do translations, we're not interested in them, so please don't send them to us. But most markets I've queried have been very open, and they said, you know, well, we'll take a look. You just go through the same process as submitting any piece of fiction. You go through the slush, and editors look at it, and if they like it, they'll publish it. I haven't found any kind of explicit higher barrier for publishing translations than for original fiction, at least in my personal experience. I found that I do submissions for both my translations and my original fiction the same way, and I definitely have not noticed one being harder to sell than the other.
So is there anything that Anglophone members of the Specfic community can do to help raise awareness of translated works?
I would say if you read a translated story, or just really any story, and you like it, you know, shout it from the rooftops. Tweet about it, blog about it, recommend to other people, because that's what keeps the community alive. You know, I discover good stories because people recommend them to me, and I love it when I see people being passionate about stories they like and trying to publicize them. Translated stories in particular can probably use that kind of help, just because the authors themselves are not in a position to help publicize their own work in English. They don't use Twitter, they don't use Facebook, in the case of Chinese writers especially, because these services are blocked. So they have to rely on readers out here who like their work to spread the word about them. So I would say that, you know, if you read a piece of translated fiction that you like, just try to spread it as widely as possible and get more people to read it.
Speaking of publicizing works, I believe that you have another translated work coming out very soon, or it might already be out.
Yes. You are probably referring to The Three-Body Problem by Liu Cixin, which is the first book in the Three-Body Trilogy, China's best-selling hard sci-fi epic series. The Three-Body Problem is the first book in the series, and it tells the story of this secret extraterrestrial search for extraterrestrial intelligence SETI project conducted during the Cold War and during the Cultural Revolution in China by the Chinese military. And the consequences that result when aliens actually hear us. So I don't want to give away the story, but the first book in the trilogy really is just the start of this very vast, vast, vast epic story that spans the time from the Cultural Revolution all the way to the end of the universe, literally. It's a story about humanity's journey to the stars, our sort of place in the universe. It answers and explores the big questions, the really big questions. It's the kind of science fiction that, you know, I really love. It's the sort of thing that Arthur C. Clarke used to do, this very grand, ideas-driven, just epic in every sense of the word kind of story. And I really like the way Liu Cixin himself described it. He says that, you know, he's interested in writing this kind of sci-fi because he finds the romance of science, of understanding the universe, to be so much more compelling and so much more grand than anything that humans have been able to do. You know, you talk about love, you talk about our petty revenges, our hatreds, our little accomplishments, our brief history of a few thousand years, but In the scheme of the universe, in the scheme of understanding what it means to for two atoms to be smashed together to generate energy, in terms of understanding how the planets form, how the suns come to each other, how gravity is generated, that these later questions are just so much more grand and interesting and compelling. And I can definitely see the appeal of that, and I think this story is a great, great example of that kind of aesthetic. So I'm really glad to have done it, done the translation. I love the story, and I think it's a very, very wonderful work, and I'm hoping that readers here will like it as much as readers in China. This story, this series of books is just, you wouldn't believe how popular they are. Just fans have made all kinds of amazing fan art. They've written fan fiction, they've done trailers, they've done art, they've written songs, they've put on flash mobs, just all kinds of stuff to celebrate their love for this work. And I really just hope that readers here will connect with it in the same way that readers in China have, because I think it's just really a wonderful story.
Well, you've sold me on it.
And it's coming out from Tor Books on November 11th. That's probably the most important bit.
I have to put that date in the calendar. I find it really interesting, though, that you say that it's talking about the big picture, you know, sort of those cosmic scale things. But if someone asked me to talk about your short fiction, I'd say that one of the things that you do perhaps better than anyone else I've read is talking about very human emotions and human interactions on a interpersonal level. So I just find it interesting that you really love that in his work, but in your own work, you're so good at doing those human interactions.
Thank you. One of the things that Chinese fans sort of were, well, when they announced that I was going to be the translator for the first book in the series, I think some Chinese fans were very concerned. Some of them probably expressed their concern a little bit more forcefully than others, but their concern mainly is that because I'm known as a writer of this very, of these very humanistic and kind of emotional driven stories, not really known for the grand big picture type of stuff. I've written some stories that are in that mode, but that I definitely agree that's not my main style. So I think some of the fans were concerned that whether I would be able to do a good job or not. Well, the fact is, we have stories that we like to write and stories we like to read, but we can also admire things that are not necessarily within our creative zone. There are many, pieces of art that I admire a great deal, that I really love and I enjoy, but they're not necessarily the kind of thing I strive to create. And I think the Three Body series is an example of that. I love these stories. I think they're wonderful and a core part of what makes science fiction great is that they do these things that so-called mainstream or literary fiction doesn't do. Literary fiction rarely tries to make a species or, a way of thinking or the universe itself a main character in fiction, which is what the series of book does and books does. And I feel that there's room for all that. And because I do like this kind of story and it's not the sort of thing I write normally, is it challenging to translate? I think so, but at the same time, I think it's also good because it forces me to not be lazy and rely on my own voice. It forces me to be careful and really read closely and make sure I'm conveying the assistant's voice accurately, that I'm expressing what he wants to express, that I'm trying to be a faithful translator, interpreter of his vision and his words into another language, another culture. And I think I've done that. I know the Cixin himself quite liked my translation, which I'm very, very gratified about. And I think the response from beta readers so far has been quite good. So at a minimum, I'm hoping that I have successfully discharged my duties as a translator in that regard.
Now, in terms of your own writing, and I'm quite unapologetic about being a huge fan of your work, and particularly...
Well, thank you.
And that's why this interview has been a bit interesting for me, because I'm trying not to fanboy too much. Though I am, quite upset with you because Paper Menagerie in particular made me cry. but as a huge fan of your work, I'm also very excited to hear that you have your own novel coming out. Your debut novel comes out sometime next year, I believe.
That's right.
Tell us a little bit about that, and I'm really curious to hear what Silk Punk is.
Right. Okay, so my novel, which is called The Grace of Kings, is coming out from Saga Press, which is Simon Schuster's new science fiction and fantasy imprint, next April, April 2015. The Grace of Kings is the first book in a planned series called The Dandelion Dynasty. It's epic fantasy. It's not science fiction. It's a little bit different from what I usually write. It's also by far the longest thing I've ever written. So I think your listeners would appreciate this. I just finished the copy edits for the manuscript, and it is currently 800 pages long and weighs 7 pounds, printed out. These are words that I never thought I would ever say about something I wrote, but it is 7 pounds. It actually is a doorstopper. Writing this sort of book has been sort of just an amazing experience all around. It's it's by far the longest thing I've ever written. I'm sure it is longer than all my short stories put together, and I have, like, you know, many short stories. It is also a much grander story. I had to really do a lot of world building and really build the whole world out to do it. But let me describe what the book is. The book is, it's an epic fantasy, but it's not epic fantasy in the Tolkien or modern Dungeons and Dragons, West European historical based type of epic fantasy at all. The basic plot of the story is a reimagining of the legends around the founding of the Han Dynasty in China, right around the time, actually it's before the time of the founding of Christianity. It is an epic story in every sense of the word. It involves many different states, many different cultures, vast armies, and it's about two people, two friends who together decide to overthrow, join the rebellion to overthrow tyranny. But then after they succeed in the rebellion, realize that they actually have to fight each other now because they have very different ideals about what the world they want to live in is like. And so it's this very romantic, happy story, heroic story that turns tragic as brother turns on brother, and they find out that this is the way a lot of revolutions end up having to be undone. So I don't want to give away everything because obviously that would be too much spoilers, but it is a story in which there's a great deal of politics, intrigue, a lot of plots, a lot of battles, and I've turned this reimagined ancient set of historical legends into a new fantasy setting in a set of archipelago, in a set of islands in an archipelago where there are jealous and conniving gods. I've added a lot of magical creatures. I've added a lot of what I call silk punk technology, which is kind of like steampunk, but they're reimagined technology based on the ancient techniques and knowledge and materials of East Asia. So bamboo, silk, water mills, windmills, animals, sinew, things like that. There's a vast and interesting tradition of these very clever historical East Asian technologies based on these materials that sometimes, mostly isn't well known in the West. So I've tried to take some of these ideas and extrapolate them and then made them, quote-unquote, awesome in my fantasy world. So this is a great story for me. It's a story I've always wanted to write. My wife and I actually created the world together. Lisa had this idea for reimagining the Han Dynasty legends in an epic fantasy. And we discussed the idea, and we both really liked it. And so she helped me do a lot of the world building. And then I wrote the books. And I've just had such a blast doing the work for it, trying to figure out the technology, trying to look through old, books about East Asian technology and researching old patent applications, trying to figure out how I can make all these things work. And then trying to design the religious practices, the gods, and so on and so forth. It's just being a blast. And I think the story is going to be, the book will be unique, because even though the storyline is a reimagining of this, ancient set of Chinese historical legends, I've tried to make a setting that's East Asian influenced, but not East Asian derived. There's a lot of elements I've taken from, East Asian models, but overall the narrative techniques I'm using is a combination of traditional Chinese historical romance as well as epics that I enjoy, such as Beowulf and Aeneid, and some bits of Iliad in there. So I think somebody who gets into this book and sort of has liked the same things that I do will really get a kick out of it, because I try to meld all these traditions in a way that's organic, that comes alive, that makes me happy. You know, I write books that I want to read, and this is a book I want to read. And so you can tell I'm super excited, and I hope readers are too.
Well, again, you've sold me, so my to-read pile is already getting bigger with the translated one and also this novel. So, no, that sounds very exciting. So I'm sure that our listeners will be keeping an eye out for that one when it becomes available.
Excellent. Yeah, it's going to be out April 7th, 2015.
So between that and your translation work, I'm going to be very jealous of your time management if you tell me you've got a lot of other stuff coming up. But what does the future hold for Ken Liu other than your novel and the translations?
There are a couple of other things I'm doing. I'm right now in the middle of working on the sequel to the novel, which involves even more awesome technology research. I can't say everything, but if you come to my website and sign up for my newsletter, I will give you sneak peeks about what I'm doing. But I'm doing something that I think has not been done before, and then I'm excited. I'm building, just to give you a sense of this, to make sure that some of this soap punk stuff work, I actually have to build contraptions myself and make sure they model contraptions myself and make sure they actually do work. So my daughters are really enjoying these things I'm building for them to make sure that the stuff that I'm imagining actually will sort of work out within an order of magnitude. And so I'm doing a lot of research into kites and static electricity properties of silk, things like that. It's a lot of fun. I've been working on the sequel since July, and it's coming together. It's definitely hard to do a novel, and it is a lot of work. But I'm having such a blast that doesn't even feel like work sometimes. I'm also translating another novel from Chinese called The Waste Tide. This one is by a writer named Stan Chan, who some readers, some listeners may be familiar with, because one of his short stories that I translated was published in FNSF, I think last year. It's called The Year of the Rat. This one is, The Waste Tide is a cyberpunk thriller set in China in the near future, and it is very cool. Stan is a great pro stylist, and he has this great way with languages. So one of the things about the novel is that it's setting a part of China where the various phonetic languages are all coming together. So you get to hear a variety of different dialects and the very complicated social status and relationship that speakers of these various phonetic languages are demonstrating by using the various languages. And that part, of course, is very hard to translate, but I think it's fascinating, and I think people will love it. Stan also has some really cool, interesting technological speculation about what would happen in this cyberpunkish, cyborgified world of the future. And it's also only the first book in a series. And The Wayside has actually already been optioned for TV. So I can't wait to introduce this book to readers in the West as well. I think it's going to be awesome. Other than that, I have a few short story commitments that I promised people I would get to. So I need to get that done before the end of the year. But other than that, I think that's it.
as if that's not enough. Well, look, thank you so much for your time, especially being so busy. It's been great talking to you, and I'm sure that the listeners are going to get a lot out of this. Hopefully, next year when your novel comes out, we might be able to get you back and talk about some of that.
That would be awesome. That would be awesome.
But it's been a real pleasure, so thank you so much.
Same here. I really enjoyed chatting with you, and thank you so much for having me here.